Hello, and welcome to episode 68 of the Crate and Crowbar, a podcast about PC gaming. It's the 11th of November. I am Tom Francis, and with me here today are...
Chris Thurston.
And...
Marsh Davis.
And that's it. And the news this month, week, whatever,
week.
Is that...
Today.
Maybe it will be the biggest news of the month, we don't know yet. Just Cause 3 is a thing. Game Informer doing their usual month of... drip-fed bullshit. I was just frustrated because it was announced and then there was a video and I was like, oh, awesome, I want to see it in action. And then there's just nothing in the video. It's just interviews with the people and like some still shots, which is not even clear if they're screenshots or not. And they've been working at 3 years, I guess, I learned that from the video. And there were some screenshots, like, just a week ago that were meant to be leaked Just Cause 3 screenshots that showed a sort of... they're muddy and uninteresting, but one of them showed like a menu similar to the requisition menu of Just Cause 2 where you can call down new vehicles, but all the prices were in like a special currency, and then there's a thing at the bottom of like, buy more of this currency, as if it was a hideous free-to-play bullshit thing.
Which is exactly what Assassin's Creed Unity has.
Ah, really?
Yep.
Is that right?
That's true. Mm-hmm. Assassin's Creed Unity has in-game purchases of like extra currency to help you get things faster.
I like the fact that the release of Assassin's Creed Unity has been completely eclipsed almost instantly by the news that Just Cause 3 is coming.
Yeah, they timed that really weirdly, where the embargo for Assassin's Creed Unity reviews was about 10 hours after the game was released. Mm. That morning, a different sandbox game, Dragon Age Inquisition, reviews came out, very positive. Mm. That game's out until next week. And then immediately after the reviews came out, another sandbox game that arguably we were more excited about was announced.
Yeah, EA won that one, really, didn't they? Like,
is Just Cause EA?
No, but Dragon Age.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah,
it's all different publishers. Square Enix is Just Cause. Mm-hmm. But they did. So just before we started this, I checked on the Game Informer site, and one of their first stories is to clear up the confusion to say that Just Cause 3 is not free to play. But that's it. They don't say anything else. They don't deny that those screenshots are real or say that there won't be microtransactions. They just say it's not free to play. And the statement from Square Enix says, it will definitely be a completely full price game. Don't worry, we're definitely going to charge you full price in order to make the rest of the shit. There's no danger of us giving to you for free. You can rest easy, folks.
I like that they're confirming all of the things that make it worse, potentially. Like, what matters is whether or not there are microtransactions, not how much you are also expected to pay. Yeah. Like, as if for some reason what people make people angry about free-to-play games is the freeness, not the fact that they're not really free.
I'm still excited. I don't know what they'll do with it, because I don't know if they know what was wrong with Just Cause 2. Like, it's easy to point to... you can point to like a bunch of small stuff, but, I mean, some of the missions were shit, a lot of the missions were shit. But... the bigger problem for me, it was just that all the kind of open world stuff, actually going around the awesome world and blowing shit up, it was just that. It was just blow shit up. And there was never really anything interesting to do beyond that. Like, it wasn't that... that was interesting for a long time, probably interesting for much longer than, like, a standard single-player game. And so it was a great game, and I thoroughly recommend playing it. But it was felt so crazy to have this, like, spectacular, vast, gorgeous world and this incredible engine that could just handle it with aplomb and these fantastic physics with the tying things together. For one thing, the game itself, the tying things together thing, is basically a minor novelty that doesn't really work because it just snaps the rope every time anything interesting happens. So you have to mod it to make the rope strong, and then it works perfectly. Well, not perfectly, but it works brilliantly. Like, it makes the game far, far better. But then, like, the game is never about that. It's always about just... kill these 18 guys or blow up this big facility and use this rocket launcher to destroy these things, when the fun of the game is like, I wonder if I can make that sports car wrap around that lamppost by turning it as it goes past. And you can do it, and you can mess around, and this is like the best mess around game, but it never ties it together into like motivating you to do that stuff. It always felt like it just needed a game designer to come in and say, here's what the actual system should be.
Yeah, good sandbox, but nothing but sand in it.
Sand and grappling.
Yeah, it's one of those games that I know I'll play for 3 hours, and probably that's I'll have my fun with it in that time. But after that point, I don't know.
I suppose one of the things that would concern me about a potential of a microtransaction system is it precludes a modding scene in a lot of ways. If they want to sell you, you know, cool new cars and gadgets and guns and things, then the ability for people to create that stuff for themselves has to be gated in some way, or else you obviously just undermine the purpose of the microtransaction system. And the Just Cause 2 modding scene was, as you say, what made the grappling hook so good, but also is what led to things like the Just Cause 2 multiplayer, which they kind of then subsequently adopted.
Yeah.
So I would hope that one way or another, from a sequel, I'd like them to kind of, in an ideal world, embrace the modding stuff from the beginning. It's the perfect game to allow people to fiddle with and, you know, mess around with the physics and the weapons and stuff. I kind of agree that maybe it needs more, like, direction in terms of systems, but the systems are really cool and fun to play with as they are. So, yeah. Destructible terrain would be a good fit.
I think what I want from it is something like Far Cry 3's Outposts, or even, like, Just Cause 1 had these villages that you would liberate, and they weren't that much fun, but something like that where, like, on the global map you're working towards something, like you're taking over territory and things like that. And they had, like, versions of that, but it was also trivial and isolated, disconnected from everything else.
You were kind of knocking down propaganda-spewing stations of some kind, weren't you, in the second one? I don't think it had any kind of... You didn't feel like you were conquering the map in any kind
of... Yeah, you were trying to increase this chaos meter by destroying things, but it was... there were, like, specific posters you could graffiti to do that. But also just, like, just blowing up a village's water tower so that they'd all die of thirst. That was counted as, yay, you're helping topple the government, well done. You just do terrible, terrible things to the people who live there. It's all good.
Are you saying that's not Just Cause?
No, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Assassin's Creed, what's the word on that then?
Mixed so far.
Yeah, it's been all over the fucking shop as far as I can tell. The scores, reactions.
The most positive takes I have seen, such as official Xbox Magazine's review, all of the reviews so far are based on console versions of the game. PC versions of the game, as far as I know, weren't available until launch.
That's why Tom Senior isn't here this evening.
It is, because he's currently Arnoing it up in revolutionary France. I have, however, heard from a friend that there is an audio diary or something where Danny Wallace's Assassin's Creed character makes fun of Les Mis.
Yeah.
Therefore, fuck that game. I will now never
play it. He says he prefers cats, the motherfucker.
What a dickhead.
Yeah.
I'm now angry. I came to not like necessarily, but accept Danny Wallace's character over the course of multiple Assassin's Creed games. Initially, I hated him, and then over time, he gained a bit of a personality, but just one thing about Danny Wallace personally. But his character, Sean, I don't know, I don't know why he was there. But, and he, you know, he fought his way back into my heart a bit with Assassin's Creed 3. He was actually quite funny in Assassin's Creed 3, and that is a dour fucking game. But now he's right back in the fucking Brotherhood books. Ah.
It was pretty funny, actually. I read the transcript of that little bit of the section. You know, it was pretty...
Yeah.
It's a good hat tip to Les Mis, you know.
It is, but the hat tip they needed was making a musical.
Like, yes.
I think so. The positive takes I've heard about it are saying that it's a bit of a return to Brotherhood, like a single city focus. And the negative things is that it has lost all of the kind of scope and mad kind of, you know, system... feature creep that set in by, you know, Assassin's Creed 4, but which nonetheless resulted in Assassin's Creed 4 being a brilliant pirate game.
Do you know how the co-op works in that? Because I've read official Xbox's thing, and they said that their co-op review is going to be a separate thing coming later in the week, which seems sensible. But I also read Kotaku's review of it, which mentioned the co-op, said it was rubbish, but didn't say why. After saying it was the focus of the game, I was no clearer as to how the co-op even functioned.
Don't you... always see yourself as Arno, the main character, but that's your friends drop in as other members of the Brotherhood, and you all think that you're Arno.
It's like a weird group hallucination.
Yeah, that's where that dumb argument from a few months ago about, you know, that it's too difficult, too expensive to put female characters in, that's where that, one of the reasons for that message getting a bit lost in translation, dumb message though it is, was that Arno's, like, everyone's Arno, and, you know, a protagonist has to be this man, because... what else would he be?
I think they could have probably integrated their multiplayer system in a slightly less diegetic way. If they just had it as a lobby system where you go into the Animus and bloop, you're another character, that'd be fine. But I guess they wanted to have it just work seamlessly in some
way. Yeah, it is a weird decision.
I can see why they'd want to preserve it, preserve the kind of integrity of the fiction that might have been like an important, well, such as it is.
Sorry, I just can't hear you saying that. the integrity of Assassin's Creed fiction.
Well, the integrity, okay, the integrity of its historical setting then.
Yeah,
because I think that is generally quite consistent.
Yeah, that's worth preserving, which is why it should be musical.
They certainly stick to their guns. I don't know if you call it integrity, but like, they won't fucking drop the future shit, will they? They're just going to keep on fucking doing it.
Apparently there's no future stuff in this one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'll take that back then.
How is Danny Wallace in it? Is he?
I think he's in like the codex entries, basically, and the like. But there's no going to the future.
Right.
You're still in a simulation, genetic simulation of the past, but you never leave it.
Right.
Except to access the microtransactions menu.
Yeah, exactly. Except with your real money.
What are the? Were you microtransacting?
I don't quite understand. It's like a secondary currency in the game. I got that from an image. I didn't really do any diligence on it yet, but it's still shit if that's true.
I am glad because it means I don't have to reinstall Uplay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really feel like I'm interested in this one, and I do love the setting potentially, but
it does look fucking amazing.
It does look amazing.
I think Video Game posted a shot which was not half real Notre Dame, half digital Notre Dame, and one said game and one said real on it. And I actually thought, oh, they've done that thing where they switched around the two names, and I was like, oh no, have they? No, they haven't. No, they haven't. But it's that good. It's quite impressive.
Maybe I'll play it. Well, I bet if it ever actually unlocks on Steam. I have it on Steam, but I don't think I'm supposed to have it on Steam, and it's been removed from Steam for sort of public access. But I've like literally installed it. It's on my computer now, but it won't let me. It's saying it's preloading. So I've got myself into a weird state with it. If the only way to play it is for me to separately install Uplay and re-download the 60 gigabytes of files, then I'm not playing it.
Yeah. I didn't finish 4. I think that might have been like after really loving the pirate stuff. I think that was probably the end of me in Assassin's Creed. After a pretty long relationship with that series, 3 was bad, 4 was great, but I don't know. I don't really to sustain my interest in clearing out all the world maps.
Yeah.
Is Rogue coming to PC?
Yes, next year.
Is that... Isn't it out on consoles now?
Yes.
But what the hell are they doing? Released 2 Assassin's Creed games on the same day. Because I heard some of the console reviewers saying that Rogue, like, they got Unity code, but they weren't given Rogue code. And they were saying this is like, maybe Rogue is being sent out to die. But it sounds like that one has ships in it, and is maybe closer to
AC4. That's so strange. I mean, they really couldn't milk that franchise more than... It would make some kind of semblance of sense if Black Flag hadn't been an Assassin's Creed game, had just been a cool ships man game.
And, cool ships man.
And Rogue was cool shipsman 2. The cool ships in ink. That would make more sense, although it should
too
be called
cool,
that.
Two ships.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, why not? And then Assassin's Creed could be a musical and we could all move on with our lives. Still cross about that. Like, I thought there would at least be like, a pastiche or something, or a moment, or a reference. I get that it's a different French Revolution, Danny Wallace, but the point is that you got this fucking precious opportunity standing right in front of you. They didn't step back from making Ezio Auditore ride around in a paraglider created by Leonardo da Vinci from the back of a speeding chariot to chase down like an Ottoman princeling. So why did they back off from this? It's travesty.
It's a fair criticism.
I'm so angry.
Maybe they don't care about it as much as you do.
That's nonsense. Then they're objectively wrong.
How have you been objectively wrong this week about Dragon Age?
Oh, dear.
And you'll continue to be objectively wrong for the rest of this podcast.
Really?
I don't know.
Have I?
Nah.
You haven't played it yet.
You probably like it.
I do. So
and that's automatically wrong.
Exactly.
Not according to the internet. Not according to the internet reviews.
Is there consensus?
Yeah. Very high critical consensus, which means I lost our bet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Well, so far, depends on when we're going to call it. We had a bet on what Dragon Age Inquisition's meta score was going to be. I thought it was going to do very well, but with at least one or two kind of nitpicky fives out of tens somewhere in the lower end of the region. It hasn't got them yet. It's universally high praise. I think it's averaging out 88 so far.
That was PC Gaming, didn't
it? 87.
Bang
on the zeitgeist.
Oh, wow.
Nailing that time ghost.
Nailing that time ghost, what?
The zeitgeist.
Oh, right, is that what it means? Yeah. I don't know.
Which is funny, because there's a time ghost, it's a segue, but it would have been, but no one has played the game. So,
some listeners are chuckling at home at that.
Maybe if they're listening to this, like, in the future, anyway.
Oh, yeah, because it's not even out yet.
No, it's not. So the last episode of the podcast, for various NDA reasons,
last time on the Creep and Crowbar,
I couldn't talk about anything past the opening of the game, which is actually the most contentious part of the game. I have now played 30 hours of it, and I love it. Like, I can see, I've had a lot of discussions with people who are also reviewing it, and I can see some of the things that people don't like about it. I would be absolutely, to be honest, it's already my game of the year, and there's nothing is going to beat it. But I don't think there has been a more game that's been, more of a personal, reward and relief for me in that way. It's similar to when Mass Effect 3 came out, and every other game that year had to compete with the accumulated depth of interest I had in that series over the course of the two previous games. So really, every other game that year had to be better than not just Mass Effect 3, but the entire series. And the same with this. Every other game this year now has to mean more to me than my accumulated time with the Dragon Age series over, 4 or 5 years now.
Hmm.
So, with that in mind, it's also, I'll get some specifics. It's also, I think, the first game I've played, really, apart from possibly Alien Isolation, that has felt genuinely like next gen, and I don't normally like that phrase.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have that magic trick that games sometimes do where you just don't really know how something has been achieved technically. And it used to be more common, right? And then the long console generation things slowed down and you see the ropes and you learn more about how games are developed and you start to see the fringes of how it all fits together more. The technology behind Inquisition has hit me like that multiple times, and also its scale. It's enormous. They weren't kidding around when they said that one zone in that game is bigger than Dragon Age Origins. It's stupidly big. So much so that it's intimidating. And that's possibly one of its weaknesses, is it gives you so much to do. And so much of it you're welcome to ignore. It's just, there's always things you can be doing. It's these vast open world zones.
Is it all open to you from the start, or is there?
No, but this is the thing. There's a very, very snappy introduction. And at the end of maybe the first half an hour of very basic, introductory conversations and here's the plot, you are let out into the open world, into a zone that's absolutely enormous. I have left behind 24 quests, and I've explored maybe just over a third of that zone. And those 24 quests are from the places I've been. There's lots of it I haven't been to yet. And I feel comfortable with the amount I did. I did everything that felt like high priority, and I left behind some of the lower priority things. And the game doesn't punish you for that. It's just hey, this is what you can do. You don't have to. And the stuff I can go back and unlock later. And then I moved on. And I didn't feel like I was playing particularly slowly. I was exploring areas, making sure I was recruiting all the companions and stuff, and I felt like the game had begun. And then, 20 hours in, I finished the prologue. Because the game actually starts quite significantly after that point. In a way that I really can't explain too much without spoiling, but it does this weird thing where it almost opens up the world map again, and it just shows you the full expanse of what you can do in the game. And unlocks a whole bunch of new systems regarding your home base and the kinds of things you can do in your home base with regards to the politics of it and upgrading it and talking to people and all that stuff. And then when you see that, then it all kind of clicks and that's the game. And that moment arrives at the end of the most extraordinary series of narrative beats and fan service I think I've seen BioWare ever do. It was 4 a.m. when I did it. I don't know why I was up late. Oh, I did a Destiny raid. I ended up late, but I knew I had this one mission I wanted to do. And the game, it's a story mission, and obviously the game sort of indicates it's going to be important, but you have no idea how, and they do a bunch of narrative things I'd love to talk to when it's spoilable, that sort of shift your expectations about what's going to happen in the mission. The very, very BioWare thing of the mission briefing is kind of wrong about what you're actually going to do and what the parameters are going to be. A surprising thing happens. And, that leads to a lengthy sequence, a long couple of hours shift. It feels almost like the finale of another BioWare game. That moment when you hit the kind of, the no turning back button and you go in this sort of location hopping kind of series of events that ends in the end of the game. In Inquisition, that ends in the beginning of the game, really. There's a huge series of climactic events and, oh man, I wish I could talk about it, but just an amazing moment of, like, kind of weirdly, like, beautiful cinematography, which you wouldn't necessarily expect. I'm trying to... just, like, a beautiful narrative beat that's so well presented that it's kind of, like, a sort of spine-tingling thing that it's a really human point about that thing we were talking about last week about how the game addresses matters of faith and gives the player control, where the player character is kind of hailed as a messiah. And as the player, you have a lot of control over how you feel about that, whether you go, no, I'm not, or I'm not sure, or yeah, I am, or whatever. There's a moment, which I won't spoil, but it'll give you the vague themes, which is when the game answers that like internal problem you're having in a really intelligent sort of humanist way, where rather than like having a character literally come along and say, oh, here's the answer, you are or you're not. It's just made really clear to you that the people who've come to depend on you kind of need you to be right now. And that is just done with a hymn in the dark at a really low moment. And it's beautiful. Like, it's an amazing moment of, like, it's something Mass Effect never did, which is, like, this sort of, like, kind of great collective, like, moment of humanity, rather than everything being kind of, like, clinical and sci-fi. It's so well done. It's really nice. And that is then followed by two extraordinary bits of fan service in a row. And by that point, I was so excited I couldn't sleep. That was a very tiring night for me. And so, yeah, so the reasons that maybe this is going to be my game of the year is shit like that. Like, you can't, like for me, that could be that could be the peak of the game, and I'm happy now. But it's just getting better. And so that's the sort of scope of kind of how far I've gotten so far, and I this might be frustratingly vague to listen to, I don't know, because I really don't want to spoil it for people. The reason it's a big success for me is because I find that it's very successful on both the large scale, in terms of being impressed by how much control you feel like you have over the world, and the small scale. And that comes down to things like how missions can sort of drift in and out of the zone in which they take place in. So you have the ability to send your advisors off to do things on the world map, which I think I discussed last week, and it takes real time. So you'll be told a different advice take a different amount of time, depending on whether they're the appropriate one, but they'll have different outcomes. And it's broadly sending spies, sending the army, or sending diplomats. But obviously, if you're, you know, negotiating with nobles, you can send the army, but it's not, you know, it'll get you a different set of results.
Surprise, motherfuckers!
Yeah, or like you use the army in interesting ways. Like there's one, and this isn't a spoiler. You find out that there's some nobles plotting against you, and so you know one of the options is you can use some spies to place some evidence and disgrace them. You can send diplomats to just talk them down, or one of them is you can invite them to a demonstration of your army drilling, which just convinces them not to do anything. Which is just a nice, like, that's the use of the army in that context. But each of them get you different things. But missions, and not only is that used to kind of deliver quite a bit of narrative, if you don't mind doing the reading, because it sort of helps to fill out what's happening in the world that you might not be directly involved in, but missions kind of drift in and out of it as well. So an example would be, I need to find a particular location for a main quest. So in order to get to that location, I first need to send scouts, which is kind of like, it's an action that doesn't take any time, but I need to spend the Inquisition's power to do it. And you acquire power by doing pretty much anything in the game. So I've acquired some power, I spend the power to unlock the region, which is a region I can now go to as an actual, like, adventuring zone. And I go there to do my main quest, but on the main quest, I get there and I discover that there's, like, a village, and the village is under threat. And I complete that quest, which is sort of a distraction, but it gets me some other things, and I also unlock a fortress for the Inquisition in that region along that thread, which is then a fortress that gives me more stuff, allows me to do more things, gives me a base in that region then. But also, on the way, I find out that the mayor of the village who was responsible in some way or culpable for what happened to the village, rather than then tracking him down in the game, I then go back to the world map, or back to the war table in the Inquisition stronghold, and have the choice of sending the army after him, diplomats after him, putting out a wanted message, or sending spies after him. So that then is sort of handled for me while I do other things. And then when I come back, next time I'm back in the stronghold, and that mission's been completed, he's in the dungeons. The mayor has now been taken to the dungeon. And
could you have tracked him down in the real world?
No. So that, but I think the idea is that you kind of, like, at some point the quest sort of just goes, you know, goes off into the rest of the world while you do other things, and then another character will come back and update you on what happened.
So when you say you've gained a fort or something like that, that's a physical fort that is modelled in the world. Yeah. How does its physical manifestation change as a result of your acquisition?
The Inquisition logo all over it.
Right.
If it's a spy fort, it gets big metal owls.
Cool.
Make sure it's on brand.
Yeah. It's there's a few things. So, I mean, the game is dizzyingly complicated, and I'll just sort of, I'm just going to drill down into little things to give you an example of how it works. But so you open the fort. That gives you. You can also. The equivalent of like any other open world game where you might synchronize or do something is finding a camp place and building a new encampment, which allows you to like change your party members, fast travel, and replenish potions. So in the game, there's no way of healing in combat apart from potions, and you have a finite amount of potions, 9 for your entire party. And so the time you can spend adventuring before you need to find new supplies, and you can't loot them in the environment, you can only get them by replenishing your stocks at an Inquisition base. Or at certain points in dungeons and stuff. And that's used to kind of not gate your progress, but give you like a meaningful reason to kind of like say, I've explored enough on this expedition. I'm going to loop back round. You can't sort of wander forever without eventually running out of health, basically. Which actually works really well as a kind of like thing to structure the game, because you're always also finding new camps. So you, if you know what I mean, that's your kind of reason to find checkpoints and things like that. So your fortresses give you that. They also unlock quests in the region, both in the region and on the world map, which in turn might lead to other things. And for example, there's an extensive crafting system, like really customizable weapons and armor and stuff like that. And that's all based on resources that you find by right clicking them as you walk around the environment. But when you have a fortress or a significant presence in a region, you can then spend your advisors to go get them for you when you're up. So if you don't want to do that, you can just say to the army, like, go mine iron for me for an hour. If you don't have anything else you want them to do, but obviously that's the thing.
Can you get your spies to do that?
Yeah. I think the flavor text, it kind of establishes how each of them do it. So the spies.
We'll just look at the iron for a long time until we're really sure where to strike.
Yeah, exactly. But it works quite well. You know, so stuff like that, like it's all kind of the useful kind of, how do you want to go about maxing out your presence in this region kind of thing. But then like, for example, when you get that, so you get the mayor and he's in your dungeon. When you're back in the Inquisition Stronghold, you then have the ability to sit in judgment, which is your thing as the Inquisitor. And this is like a, not a dynamic system because it's tied to specific characters you meet, but it's dynamic enough in that it's like, if you do these quests, you might get a chance to sit in judgment over villains that you meet rather than just like killing them in the mission themselves. So it sort of takes what would normally be the moment at the end of the Mass Effect quest when you say, yes, I am going to execute this for you for what you did, and moves it slightly later in the game. So like normally just the Inquisition agents will show up and drag them away, and then you in your fortress later, you literally sit in a big throne with your hand, with your chin on your fist and go, you know, or take them outside, you can execute them yourself, you can get someone else to execute them, or you can like, depend, there's lots of like bespoke things based on who they are. So you might return the criminal to the king whose territory he actually committed the crime in, for example, because it's the more diplomatic option, because you're a kind of extra national organization as the Inquisition. And that's just like one tiny thing. Like that is just a little fragment of how like one small part of the game comes together in the open world. Like I've given it another example, like the environments themselves are huge, like really genuinely big, and you can jump and move freely unlike other Dragon Age games. So it's, you have much more significant freedom of movement. And, they look astonishing. Like the Frostbite engine is great at this stuff. It's great at oceans and cliffs and that kind of thing. And that's great from just exploring point of view, although it's intimidating how big it is. And, I have found one thing I would say is every other previous Dragon Age game, trained you to click on everything in the environment, to always push the fog of war to the furthest extent you could, to always open up the entire map, always do everything, always click everything, because that's where all the good stuff comes from. If you try and take that approach to Inquisition, you'll just go insane. Like, you can't possibly click on anything. Like, the crafting materials respawn, for God's sake, unlike Origins or 2. So if you think, oh, I have to pick up all of the elf root, you'll just do that forever. And I was talking to a friend today who said that he kind of hated the open world stuff because he'd sort of driven himself insane trying to do everything before moving on. And if you do that, you'll hate it. Like, it is a game about prioritizing, and you might get given, your task list will just fill up with stuff. And if you're the kind of person who likes an empty task list, that will drive you crazy, but you just have to kind of prioritize and think about what's important to your character and what's important to the stuff you want. What do you want to get out of this? Why are you in the region? Do you want power for the Inquisition? There are things you can do that make more sense than others. Do you want to gather resources? That's another thing. I have really loved managing to ignore that. And I think actually one thing that's interesting, and this hasn't factored into reviews that I've seen, that is that sense of just like forgetting about the objectives a bit and focusing on the environment is easier to achieve on the PC than it is on the console versions of the game. And the reason for that is because of the way the game highlights loot on consoles. So one thing you have in the PC version as well is like a almost like a scan or a pinged option, which causes like a kind of like a radial ping to go out from your character, and it highlights interactable objects in the environment and sometimes helps you find secrets. So sometimes you'll be walking around and one of your companions will say, I think I've seen something, you should check this out. And if you start pinging, it'll kind of guide you to something you might have missed. But you always, regardless of the ping feature, can just move your mouse cursor over something in the environment, and if it's interactable, it'll light up, and that's fine. On the console, the only way to see what's interactable is to ping. And so what that has led to is, I think, a lot of people just pinging the ground constantly, like a kind of like a minesweeper, like trying to sweep out everything. And obviously some things are important and some aren't, but you have to see all of them. Whereas on PC, it's much more relaxed. Like, you're like, is that a thing I should go to? Mouse over? Yes, you go over there. Which is all well and good. Like, it's a really good open world game. But the reason that it's impressed me, the reason it feels like a next generation thing as a BioWare game, which have very expectations, is it has all of the BioWare stuff. It has the companions and the conversation and the banter between companions as you move around the world and the overarching narrative and the scripted stuff. But it threads that stuff into an open world game in a way that gives it a whole bunch of stuff that BioWare games haven't done before as well. And the best example I can give of this, like the obvious stuff that people, I think people will talk about a lot, is like when you see dragons for the first time. Like every zone in the game has one dragon in it. Like one dragon and one dragon only, which is kind of appropriate to that region. And you'll see it just around. Like it'll fly over and they're huge and they're beautiful. Like they really make like Skyrim look old. Like, especially in terms of animation. Like, the animation is extraordinary, and they don't have that moment. Like, Skyrim the dragons kind of looked amazing at first, and the more you played that game, the more times you'd see them do something weird. Like, I haven't got to that point with Inquisition yet. But the first time I saw a dragon, it was just fighting a giant on the seaside. And I think that's something everyone sees. Like, I think you're supposed to see that, but it was still this kind of moment of, like, what the fuck is that? And another time I was, like, moving across this dam in the pouring rain, and there's this roar, and you look up and sort of half through the clouds, you just see this kind of like massive winged shape, and it's like, I'm going to kill that later. It's a really good feeling. But the thing that really got me as a huge Dragon Age nerd was the first time I stumbled across an entrance to the Deep Roads. So the Deep Roads in Dragon Age are like dwarven roads that run underneath most of the world, because the Dwarven Empire is entirely underground, or was, before the roads were lost.
I fought some spiders there.
Yeah, you fight a lot of spiders there in the course of the Dragon Age series. But in the fiction, the idea is that entrances to the Deep Roads are hard to find. They're kind of, you know, the Grey Wardens know where they are. But if, you know, sometimes opportunistic adventurers might find them and try and find their fortune in the Deep Roads. But the idea is they're not just everywhere. And, you know, they're supposed to be sort of like unusual or signs of the past or whatever. And the games have never really managed to realise that in the reality of how you play. It's always like a character says, oh, I found an entrance to the Deep Roads, and then it's added to your map, and you can then click it to go there. And the actual act of discovery is in a conversation. It's never, you know, It's never something you actually have to do. Whereas in the books, for example, they're always described as being much more kind of like interesting, like where they're found. And there was a moment quite early before I'd done what turned out to be the end of the prologue, when I was just exploring the top of a region called the Storm Coast, which is named because it's wet and it's the coast. I'd been exploring a lot of caves, and the caves are amazing. They're really, really dark. So you have to kind of light torches and braziers, and like in some cases carry torches with you in order to be able to see. It's not like magical caves that actually glow. They're dark. And there are sometimes spiders in them. But blessedly, you only fight spiders in like pairs. In fact, there's less combat overall. Like, I've gone like 6 hour stretches without fighting a single person. Depending on what you choose to do. Like, obviously, I just happen to be prioritizing like a lot of the combat stuff a bit more, and so that's kind of, the conversation stuff a bit more, and exploring. And I was moving on coast, and the coast is kind of dotted with these kind of like giant's causeway style, like what are they called? Like the hexagonal kind of
rock formations.
And I went through another cave, and then I saw another cave, and I realized that the entrance was like too square to be natural. And there's like a huge like sort of dwarven statue on the cliffside, and it was just pure environmental storytelling. It wasn't like it didn't say like entrance to the Deep Roads unlocked or whatever, and you couldn't go particularly far into the Deep Roads. It was like, you know, the cave in a few after a little bit of exploring, but I found a chest and stuff. So what I got out of doing it wasn't, like, incredible, but it was that moment of, I've just found one of these myself. Mm. Like, which is, I've played hundreds of hours of these games, and I've never had that particular experience of, like, just interacting with the fiction in that really basic way. Felt really great as a moment of discovery. I think, again, talking to a friend who got really obsessed with a completionist approach to the open world, I can understand why he didn't have that moment, because he was too busy, like, pinging the ground and literally picking up everything and looking and opening the quest map. It's like, its maps aren't very good, and that is a genuine problem. Like, its map and its waypoint system, it's functional, but I feel like there must have been a slightly more elegant way of letting you see what's available to do around you at any given time. There's a lot of, like, checking the map and trying to reconcile the map, which is always done as, like, a pencil sketch, against what you can see around you. And all that stuff encourages you to look at the landscape a bit more, but it can lead to moments of, like, oh, it doesn't really want me to go this way, that's a cliff, I'll go around here.
Were you prioritising the conversational side of things because you were avoiding the combat?
Not really. In fact, so I would say that at the beginning of the game, the combat isn't great. It seems to vary quite a lot based on what class you're playing, like how much impact you feel that you have. Enemies tend to have quite big health bars, and you do comparatively little damage until you kind of learn what combos are effective, and you quite rapidly progress through the skill trees, and they interact, and a lot of the time, like, items are quite boring. That's one of them. That'd be a legitimate criticism. Like, a lot of the time it's like plus 5% flanking damage, so you do more damage if you're flanking someone. But that kind of speaks to the way it goes, where it gives you kind of like lots of situational advantages, and so as you get better at the combat system, it's more about using all of your situational advantages together in an interesting way. Hmm. So,
but situation, do you mean like positioning challenges then?
Positioning or based on what's just happened.
Okay.
So, like, if you want, you can play all four members of your party and, you know, pause and you know, do that and do it that way. I tend to play one character and, like, set up AI routines, which you can still do for the other four. It still has that kind of gambit system, which has been the same for the entire series. I tend to play one character. My character's an archer, and I've kind of configured him. You could play an archer that specializes in, like, traps and, like, poison and stuff. I've gone for a kind of more like a kind of stealth slash battlefield control archer. And I slowly unlocked, like, abilities that kind of, that do interesting things. So I have an ability that, takes a long time to, it's called full draw, and it's like a full draw on the bow. And that does, I've now got that set up, so that does a huge amount of damage if it's used on a target that has almost full health, because it does more damage to targets with above 80% health, and I've got another bonus from a different part of the tree that gives me bonus damage at all times against targets who have lost less than 15% of their health. So I use that as my opener.
Right.
And then that'll usually cause an enemy to close with me, and if one of the tanks in my party doesn't intercept it, then I will do a move that allows me to do like a backflip while shooting down. So you jump backwards with backflipping. And then I've got another passive, which means that my first shot after backflipping always knocks down the person.
Huh.
Like, right. It's meant to be like a fast draw thing. Yeah. And so a backflip and then shoot, which knocks them down. And then I have a third ability, which is just like a charged bow shot, but it does more damage the further away I am. So that one makes sense as a follow-up to that, because I've just jumped really far away. So when you get used to that stuff, that rhythm is satisfying. Getting that right, and, like, you can use that, like, in a group combat situation, you can use that to eliminate, like, three at once. Hmm. Or, sorry, like, one target really well, while your allies do other things.
The potions thing has me worried, because talking to other people who played a little bit of it, they said that their party would quite liberally guzzle potions.
That's based on the AI. You can switch that off.
Oh, okay.
Like,
right.
So you set up, like, a lot of if-then clauses to determine the AI, so, you know, if you want to, you can leave it as it is. And as it is, they all have something by default, which is, like, if you're lower than 15% health, have a potion.
Hmm.
Which, actually, I've left that on, because you kind of want that.
Yeah,
like, it takes away the busy work of just making them do it themselves. You can also, in this game, unlike the others, you can revive people. Anyone can revive anyone else by running up to them and, like, reviving them. Almost like, not Call of Duty, but, like, you know,
Left 4
like
Dead.
Left 4 Dead style reviving on any of your party.
Regardless of whether they've got potions or not.
Yeah. And that restores a small amount of their health, but if you want to restore all of their health, you'd probably need a potion.
Mm.
And everyone has, like, a secondary potion slot, which is, you can put different kinds of potions in. So, everyone carries health potions. But you could, for example, have your mages also carry mana potions. I have one of my rogues carry a jar of bees that she throws at people.
Cool.
So there's a lot of, and that's, you know, basically it's like healing and restoration potions, buff potions, and grenades.
If you can resurrect people, can you ever get wiped?
Yes, quite easily. Okay, right. I mean, because the enemies kind of like retarget quite quickly and efficiently. So if like I have sometimes on my main character like stealth to like get rid of aggro and then move over to revive people.
Mm.
But a lot of the time, if you lose someone important, it's quite hard to kind of split the aggro enough to get someone.
Especially if you've got all of their talents interlocking in some kind of clever combo.
Yeah. And it's interesting because a lot of the time, Phil Savage for PC Gamer pointed out in his review, and this is right, where Dragon Age 2 tried to like force the difficulty of encounters by just spawning more enemies constantly, Inquisition doesn't do that at all. And in fact, there are always fewer enemies in combat. Encounters, you know, it tends to be between like your party of four and a group of like between two and six, right? It's never like massive. But what it does do is it gives you enemies with like specific abilities that you have to learn that affect how you approach them. So a common sight is like an enemy with a tower shield, and tower shield enemies are almost indestructible from the front. Especially if someone like an archer, like you just can't do anything against them. They'll just walk towards you slowly. And so my whole like powerful long range shot jump backwards, I think it doesn't really do anything. They don't care. But they're vulnerable from the back and the side. So with those, you know, what I've learned to do with them, I have another passive, for example, that allows me to move at full speed while firing. Whereas normally you move slightly slower if you're firing your bow. So that means I can like circle strafe really quickly around them. So I'll like have one of the tanks. In one case, literally throw a chain and drag them towards the tank and start beating them up from the front. And, like, some of the tanks have, like, shield-breaking moves or armor-breaking moves, so they're quite suited to fight those guys from the front, while the archers kind of, like, flank around the sides. So there's stuff like that. Like, that's where the difficulty comes from. And so as a result, like, the healing thing... there was actually a post that the community was in uproar when they revealed the lack of healing magic or anything like that. But their explanation made a load of sense. It was that... If you give the player healing magic and the ability to have as many healing potions as the player can carry, then the player party has potentially infinite health. There is no sensible way of gauging how much health, like effective health, the player party has. You might know what their level is and how much hit points they should have at that level, but in terms of what would be called EHP in Dota, which is, you know, effective hit points, it's just an infinity sign. So therefore you can't balance encounters. You just have to hope that you throw enough enemies at them that it isn't boring. And so they said that in order to have interesting encounters, they had to limit your hit points in some way. It's the Dark Souls system. It's Estus, basically. Like, you know, if you run out of Estus flask, you feel inclined to go find a bonfire. In Dragon Age Inquisition, you run out of health potions for your party, you feel inclined to go and find a camp. And that puts a bookmark in your progress, right?
I sort of felt that way in, like, even in Diablo 1, that you had, like, a belt with 10 slots and you could put different potions in there. You might even be able to put more in there, and then you could carry more in your inventory if you wanted to, and you could put them in any time. And it was pretty rare that you would actually ever encounter someone who could drain enough health that you would use up all your potions and die. It was just a question of, could you use the potion quickly enough? I think I'm right in saying in Diablo 1, they were instantaneous. They took effect instantaneously, and there was no cooldown as well, so you could hammer them. Like, if you wanted to press the numbers 1 to 0 across your keyboard in rapid succession, you could restore that much health in that amount of time, as long as you didn't actually drop below 0 at any point. And I think, like, to an extent, that system kind of worked for a certain kind of thing, which is, like, in games, you want the player to feel like they're being challenged, but you don't actually, in most games, you don't want them to actually be failing all the time. You want them to, like, feel like, phew, that was close, but I just got through it, and I'm the hero. And so the potion thing, if you get hurt enough that you need to use a potion, you always feel a bit like, shit, that was close. Even though actually it wasn't that close, you had 10 other potions and you would have survived 10 other hits like that as long as you kept pressing the button. So kind of on a basic level, I understand why they moved away from it, because it is a very basic idea, but the idea of, like, having lots and lots of backup for failure, but feeling like you're failing was semi-effective.
Yeah, I can see that. There's a really nice animation. So that's on the grand scope, you know, you're looking at huge mountains and the kind of things happening in the open world stuff. One thing that I was going to say, that the flip side of that is, and the thing that I think creates that sense for me of, like, I've never seen a game do this right on both ends before, is that it's also full of, like, really tiny details that sell it. like, in just in the environment, like, there's a lot of handcrafted stuff in there. Obviously, you see the reuse of certain assets, but there's never, like, the reuse of whole, like, rooms or landscapes or anything like that. It is, you know, you'll see maybe the same, you know, milestone on the road, but that's kind of makes sense that they'd be consistent in some way. For the most part, you get the sense that everything's new all the time. And one of the things I really liked, I've never seen a game do this, when characters drink potions, they actually dispose of the glass. they sort of, you see them neck the potion, and then they'll just like sort of toss the glass behind them, and you see it smash on the ground, and the glass sort of scatter away. And it's completely, there's no reason for that to be there, other than it sort of sells the idea of what it's, you know, what it's like to be in that world quite nicely. You know, that's, you know, people in combat do, because the notion of a potion in a fantasy game has always been a bit of an arbitrary one, like, potions don't work that way, medicine doesn't work that way, it doesn't instantly restore you to health. But assuming that it is something that exists, the fact that they've kind of grounded it in the way the character behaves and moves, I really like.
I'd like to see a bar fight where someone bottles somebody with a health potion and the spilling health heals the glass cuts as it comes out.
Yeah, exactly. There's actually a rogue subclass in Inquisition that specialises in smashing glass, like vials of things. Like their kind of combat moves are all about like concoctions that they kind of smash in strategic ways about the battlefield, so it's kind of, yeah. The other thing, and probably the most important thing for people reading this is, listening to this even, is the writing is great, for reasons, that I would take best, a little bit of explanation, but, it has, as has been pointed out multiple times, a absolutely astonishing amount of lore. And I really like the Dragon Age lore. Like, I don't think all lore is created equal. I don't think backstory is a bad idea by default. I think there's only bad backstory, you know what I mean? Not a bad implementation. I really like Dragon Age's world. I think it's really cleverly constructed. There's a lot of interesting things in it. But it does, as the third game in a series and the game that's trying to bring a lot of the stuff together from the previous games, it does ask you to do a lot of reading in the codexes. I mean, the codex entries are actually, you know, good for the most part and interesting, and they're all like diegetic rather than exegetic. They're all like, you know, letters you find and stuff like that that have some value to them. And often they're quite funny. Like, the one for giant spiders is great. Like, the one for giant spiders is really funny. It's just it's a deliberately creepy description of why spiders, of a theory from, like an eccentric mage that spiders were always big and the little ones are actually the aberration. but it's such a detailed, description of what it might be like to feel a giant spider like crawl up down your back, that it's designed to make the reader creepy and feel creeped out. You know, it's like, you know, like, but what if you did feel like the whisper of, you know, the sort of light touch of air on the back of your neck? What would that be like? And it's designed to make you feel like weird. And then at the end, it's just like, you know, this report was widely condemned because he's a jerk. And there's a little touch like that. It asks you to do a lot of reading, and almost every companion has a sort of extra dialogue tree that's not related to any particular cutscene, where you can just ask them extensive questions about themselves and their people and where they're from and their relationship with all the factions. So if you don't understand something, there's loads of opportunities to go out and find out, but nonetheless, it asks for your patience in an enormous way and asks for you to be open to learning things. That said, what that is in service of is a lot of dialogue that is remarkably naturalistic given the amount of lore that supports it. Because characters are not often actively explaining things unless you... Because I've seen it criticised for, like, no one explains anything. But the reason no one explains anything is that is always offset to other conversations. In the moment, people don't necessarily pause to explain that, well, in this differing interpretation of this religion, this is what happened. It's sort of... And I really like the way that affects the dialogue, because it means that you don't have that kind of, like, stop a second. It does happen sometimes, but, you know, it notably happens right at the beginning of the game, not again. When everyone calls the sort of the realm of magic in Dragon Age the Fade. Everyone calls it the Fade, apart from some elves, they call it something else. But, like, it's never, like, just called, like, Demon Land or, like, you know, whatever. And, you know, the metaphysics of the Fade are a big and complicated part of the story. And at the very beginning of the game, like, one of the first lines of dialogue to your character after the very opening cutscene is basically, there's a problem with the place where demons live. And... it stands out for being what other games would do, where they sort of hold your hand the rest of the time, people just go, it's the Fade. And if you don't know what the Fade is, you have to go and ask them, like, what was the Fade? But I really like that, because it allows characters to talk naturally about the things that are happening to them as if they understand them, because they do. And they expect you to understand, because you live there as well. And so for me, as someone who's been, like, versed in this stuff for a long time, it feels like I'm being trusted with it in a way that I really, really responded to and really like. I could completely understand people going... I don't understand. I have a fucking clue what's going on. I think it's other merits, and I think, like, you know, I think if you know, I think it's other merits pick it up out of that and say that even if that stuff bounces, you bounce off of that stuff, you'll still be sold on the moments of more, like, systemic stuff, hopefully. But I would understand. But, like, it's also very funny and has amazing swearing in it, which is also rare. I think it's the first Dragon Age people say fuck, and it's really well timed. I think they watched a bit of HBO between Dragon Age 2 and this, and there's you recruit a Grey Warden who's travelling alone, and the Grey Wardens are the guys from the first game that are the only people who can stop blights. Mm. Kind of gripping undead uprisings, basically. It's kind of more complicated than that, but I won't get into it. You can recruit him, but he's not really bringing the support of his organisation. He's simply bringing himself. And you can ask him, like, well, what can one Grey Warden do on his own? And the guy just sort of mumbles under his breath, save the fucking world if pushed. And it's just a really nice, like, character establishing moment of, like, swearing. And so for all those reasons that I've explained over the course of half an hour...
That is why you're objectively wrong about
it. Yeah, exactly. That is why this is probably going to be my game of the year, and I'm not even 30 hours into it. It's real good. I'm real happy that it's good.
I might play it. Consider it.
Yeah,
it's slow. It's a big slow burner. Even the companions are slow burners. Like, there's a really cool bunch, but they don't... There's no, like, I haven't met someone yet who literally, like, you know, leaps out of an explosion. It's like, hi, I'm your friend now, and I'm rad.
I like that guy in Mass Effect.
Basically, that's Jack in Mass Effect. Like, they all kind of, like, reveal their personality a little bit slowly. They have a lot of good lines, but
I think that character's also in Far Cry 2.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm kind of bracing myself for the counter opinions, but I just love it. I think it's great.
What have you been playing, Marty?
I've been playing a game you've been playing, Tom.
Oh, yeah.
I've been playing... Okay, I have to look at the name of it because I keep forgetting.
I can remember it. It's Here and There Along the Echo.
There you go. That's what it is.
Already new.
But it's not... It's kind of a game. It's also a phone line. It's literally a phone line because although you can download it as a game, you can just phone a phone number.
Oh, my God.
And it's an automated tourist service by the supposed Bureau of Secret Tourism. It's called an interlude between episodes of Kentucky Route Zero, which is an adventure game. Magic realist adventure game.
Because they just found they were churning them out so fast. They just had to, space them out a bit more. Do some extra content in between.
Yeah. Kentucky Route Zero, I have some reservations about the series, but it's beautiful and evocative, and it is kind of magic realist in a way which eventually I find just to be difficult to engage with, because... When you get to a certain point of magic realism and surrealism, you stop being able to follow a thread of causality through it, and it becomes hard to kind of have a stake in anything that's going on. It becomes just a series of non sequiturs. But this is, in a similar vein, a magic realist take on what is actually a real world underground river.
Oh, no.
I looked it up. I think it is anyway. There is an underground river called the Echo in Mammoth Cave National Park, which is in Kentucky. So it sounds like it's probably real.
Strong lead.
But all the things that are narrated about it on this tourist guide, which it says press one if you want to hear about the flora and fauna, press two if you're holding a live snake, and these kind of things. All the things it describes about it are obviously fictional or fictionalized anyway. And it plays with the parents. It's all narrated by Bonnie Prince Billy.
Oh, the songwriter.
Yeah. Huh. It's weird. I couldn't find an IMDb page for it, but I was googling who is voice actor, and it seems apparent it's him, which is weird that he would do that. But he's got a really kind of beautiful mellifluous, I assume it's Kentucky accent. He kind of just whispers to you in dulcet tones about organ music and bats and.
So to explain, like, on PC, if you're playing this digitally rather than physically calling the line, it's a incredibly high-fidelity simulation of a old-fashioned telephone, or just a landline, basically, you know, with a keypad and a receiver that you pick up, and a curly wire that connects the receiver to that handbird, which is all beautifully simulated, and you pick it up with kind of physics, you know, you drag it around in... the cable like dangles correctly and stuff, and then you click on the buttons to press them. And
you hold it further away from your ear, it actually gets quieter.
And as far as I know, the number that you have to call all isn't in the game itself? You have to look on the website or
If you download the game, it comes with a JPEG, which is the postcard advertising the phone line.
So I had to alt tab out and memorize the number and then type it back into the game. And then I don't know if calling any other numbers works, whether you can.
Well, here's the thing. So at first I didn't think there was much game aspect to it, but I think there is, although it doesn't work in the build that I've downloaded. So throughout as you dig into the kind of these layers and layers of, you know, press one to hear about this, and then there's a sub menu and a sub menu and a sub menu. Occasionally the anecdotes will say, you know, put the receiver down and ring back with this extension and you'll get a different thing. But I've not got any of the extensions to work. It seems bugged out. But I don't know if you can do that with a real phone line, but I'm not going to call an international number to find out. But what did you make of it? Did you enjoy it? Like,
it was very weird. And so I was quite into it in that, like, it's just sort of romantic in a weird way. Like, it's a beautiful title. I love, once you know the Echo is a River, particularly, like, it's such a, like, nice, name for it. And then going through the phone menu, I'm like skeptical of is this going to be of any interest at all? Cause you are just sitting there listening to the stuff. And I followed a sort of semi-whimsical path through the numbers. Like, every time it gave me some options, one of them would usually sound completely ridiculous, or like one of the first ones I picked was, if you were hearing a noise in the dark and would like help identifying it, press 2. So I press 2, and then it goes through all the different noises you might be hearing in the dark. And I won't spoil it, but there's a really good joke to do with organ music.
Yes.
But it takes a very long time to pay off, and there's a very, very long thing you have to listen to. At the end of it, a funny thing happens, and then it did the whole thing again, like it played the whole thing again. And at that point, I couldn't find any way to get out of it. I couldn't sort of cancel out, or I couldn't go back to the previous menu. And I was pretty far down the nesting, and so I didn't have the patience to go back and try a different path, because it was going to be too much work.
I listened to it all again. I mined the entire menu, I think, fairly exhaustively. But it's obviously taking facets of reality and making them fantastic in some way. And what it does, I mean, it describes, like, I mean, one of the, when it's going through different things that you might see along the Echo, it describes the something Iron Lady, Iron Maiden, something like that, which is, you infer from the description, just like an old iron husk that is floating down the river endlessly, it seems. But they're just really beautiful descriptions. It put me in mind of Invisible Cities. I don't know if you've read that. Italo Calvino.
I was going to mention Italo Calvino earlier, actually.
Weird.
Yeah.
Spooky. Same brain. Telepathy.
Yeah, that's living in the same house. We've synced up our Italo Calvinos.
Yeah. He wrote this book called Invisible Cities, which is... Do you want to take that off? You can, you know.
No, it's okay.
Okay, right.
We're not that synced up.
Yeah. Chris is in his underwear right now.
Yeah. he wrote this book called Invisible Cities, which is it's Marco Polo being asked to describe places he's visited by Kublai Khan. And he comes up with all these very short descriptions, but extremely detailed descriptions of the city. And each one have a particularly weird thing, like there's a city that's on stilts, you know, a city that floats and things like this. And one of the theories about the book is that all of the cities he describes, which are completely fantastical, are actually just weird facets of Venice that he has enlarged in some way. So all the cities he describes are the same city. They're just different aspects of it. And I wonder if there's... I don't know. And there's a Magic Realist text as well. So this is kind of... It's the same notes. But it's, yeah, beautiful to listen to.
I want to play Italo Calvino's Bioshock.
Yeah.
We mentioned it last week, but there is a game called Calvino Noir, which is Calvino inspired.
Wow.
Huh. What have you been playing, Tom?
Burnt Band. I'm sure you all heard that. That was funny.
Brigador.
BERNBAND.
Say it again, sorry.
Burn Band.
Right.
It's a first-person exploration game, kind of, which is quite old-fashioned looking. It's kind of like Duke Nukem 3D era, maybe Doom era, really, technology, in that it's a 3D first-person world, but all the characters are sprites. And for some reason, I saw screenshots of it, and it looks very colourful and intriguing and like a cool sci-fi setting. And at the bottom of the screen, your hands are sticking out, like kind of
like either a zombie or like you're going to cast a spell. You know,
oh, yeah.
games that first person games that have magic, your hands have to be in zombie pose to cast it. But you can't do anything in the game. There is no abilities or interaction of any kind. So I don't know why your hands are there. They're just like hovering as if you're going to interact in some way, but you just can't. So it's just like a purely, I don't know whether you call it an atmospheric game. It's more like just a place, like they just made a place and they didn't have an idea for a game that could take place there or didn't want to make a game for some reason. And so you just walk around it and it's kind of like a, it reminds me a bit of Nar Shaddaa, like a sort of sci-fi city with a lot of, that's very vertical and a lot of hover cars shooting past. And it's difficult to know where you are in context, like whether this is on a planet or whether it's a space station, or actually you might even say that it's a space station. But yeah, it's weird because it's, it just says the city of PFF. And it's realized as richly as it would be if they were going to make a really significant game set there. Like they were going to put a lot of effort into making a really like rich and well-realized game. But then they just didn't make the game, which is really weird. Like I've played other games where it's just like, oh, here's a really weird, surreal place. And you can wander around it. But this isn't like that. Cause it's, although it's full of weird aliens and it doesn't explain itself. There's just like, you'll just walk into a room and there'll just be someone performing on a musical instrument and everyone's gathering around just listening to them and you can listen to the music and you can wander off. And no one will kind of give you any context or any kind of explanation as what, like, what the setting is. It's not weird, really. It's just a cool sci-fi city and it's just, it's different to real life in many ways, but it's not intentionally surreal or, obtuse or just random. It doesn't have that magical realism thing. And I kind of like that. Like, it was just, someone just made a place and you can walk around it for a bit and then it's pretty clear, unless I'm wrong, it seems to me clear when it ends. You just sort of, although you can go any direction, there's, a pretty clear path to just walk past this stuff, go in any of these rooms you like, and then when you finish, there's an elevator at the end of the hall, and you go in that, and you go to a new floor. And it's, it seemed to me pretty clear that I'd seen it all. I just went to, like, I think it says 23 locations. It seemed like less than that to me, so maybe I did miss something. But I just went through it, and then felt like I'd seen it all, and then quit. It was just a nice, short, weird experience.
Is it free?
Yes.
So it's here and there along the Echo, I should say. So, if you can find.
Shall we do questions?
I think we should, probably. We've set a precedent now.
Yeah.
68 episodes ago. John Hicks, friend of the podcast, writes... excuse me. He didn't cough. I did. Dear Club and Singles Bar, what would happen in Civilization Beyond Earth if your colony ship was staffed exclusively by games journalists and or game developers? Or would the first ship have to be developers, otherwise the games journalists would starve to death? Cheers, John T.
I'd be very sceptical of any game journalists even managing to make it to the spaceport with their passports, so I think we probably need to pack the first shipment of game journalists with some PRs.
Who's covering the travel for this?
Corporate sponsors back at home. Yeah, they'd arrive and then discover they don't have a proper journalist visa for to actually do any work while they're there, so they can be there, but they can't actually help at all with any of the setup.
The Wi-Fi is not working at all. The press pack is woefully deficient, and they're not making assets available till after the trip, so what's the point?
The game developers would just be arguing over how, in theory, we should proceed, but no one would actually be building anything. It would just be an endless rhetorical debate.
Basically doomed. Yeah.
Don't go to space with us.
Don't go to space with us. This is very similar to the games journalist apocalypse scenario, where we have the least applicable skills in apocalypse to anything, apart from telling people how good the apocalypse is. We could actually review alien planets. They were equipped with a pretty thorough knowledge of, and also of Civ, to be fair. Maybe that's a bit meta, but still, I mean, we'd probably offer that, you know. That'd be the flip side, I guess. Like, if it worked according to the rules of Civ, then a lot of people would probably overemphasize how much Civ they've actually played. And doom everyone. Daniel writes, hello, popping and lock bars. Like that. Bit of pop and locking. It's good stuff. I recently finished Shadow of Mordor. Recently, he says twice. and really enjoyed the whole manipulate the orc hierarchy mechanic. I submit that the game would have been improved if branding the highest tier warchief was either impossible or extremely difficult, forcing the player to brand a low tier captain and manipulate or work them up to take the place of a chief. One of the missions was brand all the chiefs. Had branding the chiefs been impossible, it would have given a clear goal, but the means would have been far more player controlled. Also, giving the player more of a sense of accomplishment, extending the game length in an organic way. Thoughts? Keep up the good stuff, Dan.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, I think it's a really good idea.
Because I'd heard about manipulating the hierarchy and, you know, having like one guy who's on your side and then trying to clear the way for him and make sure he does well in the hierarchy. And then actually in practice it's not necessary because you can just brand everyone. Just anybody who you're in a position to kill, you're usually in a position to brand them as well. Like, it's a little bit more difficult in some circumstances, but not really.
Yeah, I wouldn't make it impossible, but I mean, if there was some way in which you could make it disadvantageous for you to just simply brand the existing war chiefs rather than work people up from the bottom, then that would be good. I don't know how you'd implement that, though.
Well, maybe when you brand them, it makes them really weak, but then each successive power gain that they do recovers.
The longer you have somebody branded, the more ranks they rise through, just the super uber they become. Whereas if you just... I don't know. But the thing is, the problem is that the culmination of that mission is just the end of the game. So you couldn't really do it so that you would have it... if you had branded all the war chiefs and they were weak, for example, as opposed to, you know, getting people to rise up the ranks and making them too powerful, your revelation that was a bad thing to do would just be like, oh, I've got to do this mission like 7 times until I luck out now.
So maybe the way to do it would be that if you brand a chief, because almost certainly there's going to be other orcs around whenever you do any of this stuff, if you brand a chief, they see you do it and they immediately execute the chief. So the higher profile the orc, the higher the chance that branding them will just immediately get them killed by their own society. Yeah.
So it makes sense that you brand somebody in isolation, like a little weakling, and then
work him up. So that and have it so that it's a guaranteed if you directly brand a chief, then they are out. So you might as well kill them.
Reading about a thing called triangularity in game design today.
Yeah,
which is it's basically risk reward. The branching paths of choice in games, one which is high risk, high reward, and one which is low risk, low reward. Apparently, that is what makes games a rich and compelling experience, according to Jesse Schell.
But you should have both.
Disagree with on many, many things.
He's saying you need both options.
Yes, because hence the triangle. Otherwise, it would just be a line.
Kind of a line. It's not a good diagram.
Rubbish.
Not a satisfying shape at all. I haven't finished Shadow of Mordor yet. Is there a dialogue line or something where you can you know, mind control an orc and yell, engage with my brand? Because if so, might be game of the year.
Yeah, the marketing team is the trick there.
The lingo is really unpleasant in that game. just branding in general is a horrible idea.
Yeah, well, branding is just... It's a weird word for what it is in real life as well, given what it originally was.
Yep, it's no... It's no more positive now than it was then.
I never really wanted to connect with a brand. Like, you know, when cows connect with brands, they're often startled and afraid and frightened and in pain. So, yeah. Anyway, Thomas writes, Dear C&C, after the singularity, which is a great opening to any question. After the singularity, instead of patching games, the corporate overlords will patch players to correct behaviours and opinions which led to unsatisfactory gameplay. If this technology were available now, how would you patch your fellow gamers or yourselves? Yours, Thomas, version 1.04.
I think I need more patience. I don't have patience for anything now. Like, I just can't play Alien Isolation any further than I have because I lose progress if I die, and so I'm just out. that's restricting the number of the range of different games I can play at the moment.
Patch out the very notion of objectivity in games.
That's a good one. I think, as myself, I'm tempted to patch out the part of me that just forgives a lot of game stories. Like, I have arguably quite low standards when it comes to game narrative, and I forgive things quite easily because I overinvest in things and I find it quite easy to get something out of a story even if I know it's bad in some way. There's like Diablo 3 where you can point to all the ways that the writing is bad but I still enjoy it and still get something out of it. And I think that's called having no taste. So I would patch taste in. But then again, I think that would ruin my joy of a lot of things. And I don't think having taste has ever made Martin happy.
No, exactly.
So as a developer, I'd like to patch everyone else to fucking read shit, please. If there's one bit of text on screen and it's telling you what to do, and what you're wondering in the game is, how do I do this thing? Fucking read the fucking text that's telling you how to do it.
Yeah, as for, I don't know, I'd like to patch out a tendency in players, this is a really vague one, a tendency to players to wander into games already knowing what they think about. I think a lot of the games I really love, or the games I'm frustrated to love, are games that require like a bit of legwork that they don't seem to get a chance at in some contexts, because, you know, they don't necessarily make a great first impression or for whatever reason. And the history of those games kind of surviving either the critical process or the court of public opinion is spotty. Dark Souls would be an example of a game that did survive it, but I can think of plenty of games that don't. And I think that all stems from people kind of putting their own need to have an opinion above a more honest reflection of the qualities of something. I think that kind of manifests sometimes.
You have to... There's a lot of games where, like, the common criticisms of them will be things that sort of don't really matter, at least not to me, but they're just normal for the genre, and this deviates from the genre in this way. So like when I'm working on Heat Signature, I have to be careful not to make it too much like Hotline Miami, because as soon as it starts to fall into the Hotline Miami category, then it has to have everything Hotline Miami has, otherwise it'll be criticised for those things, even if it doesn't need them, even if they're not necessary or not part of the actual what the game is about. I know I'll be criticised for not doing this the exact same way that game does.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I've seen a bit of this recently. It feels like a lot of the reviews for Advanced Warfare, Call of Duty, we spoke about last week, have been very positive. Or they've sort of fallen out of the kind of like average Call of Duty kind of review spread of like sixes and sevens, I think. It seems to have done pretty well. This is the first Call of Duty in years to have done pretty well. And I have not yet seen a convincing argument for that, really. Like, talking to you guys and watching you play the single player, like, I mean, maybe it's better, but it's better than a turd. Great.
You know, I'd caveat my probably unconditional loathing of that game with the fact that I am even less objective than I normally am about Call of Duty, because I just have such a kind of difficult time with that as a whole series.
Sure,
I think so often.
I think for me, what that contrasted with was the reception for Destiny, not a PC game, but nonetheless, which I love. And I would concede that it has problems, but it has problems that come from being incredibly ambitious.
Yeah.
But it's quite easy to pick holes in. And so the response seems to have been, pick holes in the incredibly ambitious, but flawed in some ways, MMO shooter. Whereas you see Call of Duty in sort of a lot of contexts, I'm not just talking about game reviews, I'm talking about general reception, where there's a sort of implicit attitude that maybe it's time for there to be a good Call of Duty, so we'll just sort of roll out the carpet for this one, even though it's still...
Yeah, maybe, but
maybe I'm being too...
You're probably right, but I mean, I also think that genuinely affects people's enjoyment of things, is what they're predisposed, and that it doesn't become like a disingenuous reaction to say you enjoyed something, even if you've been carried to it on a wave of hype, you know? I don't particularly care about what people think about games now.
No,
come to that.
I don't know.
If you liked it, cool.
I don't know what I'd say about Advanced Warfare if I was reviewing it, because I haven't played like the co-op and I haven't played the multiplayer. But I've reviewed 3 Call of Duty games, and each time I've really hated something about the single player campaign. And each time there's been enough other stuff going on to redeem it to some extent. Like Black Ops is the lowest score I give them, which is 60 something. And I hated the single player campaign completely in that. Hmm. But the multiplayer is still good, so it's still a thing that you spend money on this.
I suppose that is a good time.
I've always liked the multiplayer in COD, really.
Modern Warfare 1 had enough good stuff in the single player campaign, enough like really cool moments we'd never seen before, that it was worth recommending on that strength. And then Modern Warfare 2 didn't have enough good stuff in the single player campaign. Then it had a co-op mode, which was brilliant.
Hmm.
So it was always like, I could never quite pan one. If only it had been just the single player, I could have really ripped into Black Ops. But damn it, it had some merit to it.
Yeah, I know that's probably fair. I probably am being unfair to Call of Duty. It just sometimes feels like the narrative of a game needs the critical opinion and the public opinion in a way that I would patch out if I were to Deus Ex ending.
But it's like you patching in taste. I mean, you're denying people pleasure, albeit misguided pleasure,
yeah,
given by some kind of mass delusion. But you know, that's pleasure nonetheless.
Why can't everyone hate what I hate?
I think that's the thing.
Don't second guess people's enjoyment of something. I suppose
I'm not. What I'm protesting is that kind of like
wave. I do that all the time.
Yeah, I know you do, but like that kind of like just riding the sine wave of public opinion thing. It's fun when you're on the kind of like, hey, we all like this now. But when you're in the doldrums of, we've all decided to hate this, and it's like the backlash clock. Whenever a high profile game is released, guarantee you this will happen with Inquisition, right? A timer began today, and the timer will create a wave of hype now. And then next week we'll roll around and the game will come out and there'll be a big rush of public approval, and then by about a week after that we will start to see the "but is it that good really" argument.
Well, there's actually,
here's what's wrong with Dragon Age Inquisition.
Yeah, like, of course there are things wrong with it, but the point is, like,
there's a logistical reason why that will be the case with that particular game, because the reviewers who will have accepted the challenge of reviewing such a large game will probably be people who are already predisposed to like it to some degree, right? That genre. And it's going to take anybody else who's going to pick it up at retail, for example, quite a long time to get through it. And so you're going to have a delay before people who are not predisposed to like it even manage to finish it and have a critical opinion.
It's a big game, and I would be interested to see what the spread was of critics that were predisposed to like it, honestly.
Yeah.
Because
I'm not saying they're predisposed in, like, Zong-biased kind of way. I'm just saying, like, people are... If you really hate RPGs, you're not going to...
Yeah.
If you're not the RPG guy on a magazine, you're not going to...
Probably not, no.
Gonna review it, right?
I mean, but what I'm saying is that, like, this goes beyond Dragon Age or any individual game. There is a fucking timer that starts when a game comes out. It is from moment of release to... But here are some things I noticed that are probably slightly wrong about it.
Do you remember with Bioshock?
Yeah, Bioshock is a perfect example of this. It's like, this is amazing. We haven't seen a story like this or a world like this. And then, but is it actually?
That was the time I was really depressed about it, because I was so in love with that game. And then when it seemed like there was just going to be, the backlash was getting more and more, I was like, God, is this really it? Like, just no matter how good it is, there just has to be the backlash, and the backlash ends up being the final opinion. Luckily, it ended up swinging the other way, and like enough people were pissed off by those pieces that they came back with the sort of resurgence of... stop criticizing Bioshock so much.
Edge Magazine lowballed that game before anybody else. I like
it. Well done.
We lowballed it with an 8, which is considered sacrilegious by members of the internet. But,
I mean, I think that's the thing. It's like, regardless of the benefits of people all being enthusiastic about something, even if it's uncritically, and the sometimes arbitrary nature of criticism, all I really want to patch out is that the notion that opinions are a fight. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the notion that your opinion is a weapon to use to beat someone else up, as opposed to just the way you feel about stuff. Like, that would be great.
It's funny, it just feels like, I think the reason you get this kind of back and forth, the sine wave you're talking about, is that people only feel the need to speak up if they feel like the zeitgeist is against them. Like, everyone's saying, this is good, it's overrated, I gotta say why it's bad. And then when those come out, everyone who likes it is like, but everyone's saying it's bad, is that really the zeitgeist now? Does everyone think this is bad? But it's great, I gotta say why it's great.
It's like the watching IGF judges' comments threads.
Yes, exactly. Like,
womp, from one side to the other.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't really isolated a problem with the gaming community here so much as a problem with humans and democracy.
Yes, patch out humanity. And democracy. Patch out democracy, that's what we need. Right? We're all in agreement here, aren't we?
This question is spiraling out of control.
Good.
He's looking at you. Okay. Stan Bennett writes, "Dear Crumbly Corkboards..."
Ooh, lovely. Would you eat a corkboard?
Weird response.
Apparently it might look nice, but probably wouldn't taste that great.
No.
Anyway.
Yeah. "I love a good game trailer. What I didn't realise is that I also love a good agricultural trailer. The kind that attaches to a surprisingly beautiful 50-ton earth-moving machine, trundling around to gentle jangly music on rolling sunset-streaked fields. Steam just spat the Farming Simulator 2015 trailer in my face, and it's genuinely one of the most moving pieces of film I think I've ever seen." My question is this. Have you ever had an unexpectedly emotive reaction to a game or its promotional materials? Probably stick with the promotional materials, because emotive reaction to a game is a much more general thing.
Yeah.
Cheers, Stan on Wheels.
I read this email and I was like, what? So I went and watched the trailer that he's talking about. And I didn't have the same reaction to him. I didn't find it massively emotional, but I did watch it and think, "Car, that looks good." The farming simulators have really good, like come along since the last time I paid any attention to them. They're like really beautiful now, and the trailer is trying to sort of sell. It's clearly the footage they're showing is showing an enormous range of various working the land type activities you can do in this game, and showing off the range of like, here's how many fucking tractors we have, and here's the awesome machine that clamps onto a tree and then cuts the tree off and then loads onto a truck, and it's kind of showing all the nerdy stuff. But then there's a sort of breezy sentimental song playing over it. It's about like happy country life, and there's birds tweeting in the background, and so like the aesthetics of it are trying to make you feel like, ah, just relax and enjoy the lovely countryside. But then the clips are showing like, look at all the awesome technical stuff you can do. So I think they've decided they have two different sets of their audience. There's people who just like to relax and stuff, and there's people who are really like fucking tractors.
They really like fucking tractors.
Yes.
There's a subreddit for that.
So for me, the tree cutting thing has actually got me really excited. I was like, oh, can I really cut down a tree in that with that cool machine? That looks great.
I think I again, this comes back to my having no taste thing. I get kind of like, I hate myself for this, but like, I am really easily moved by trailers for things. And it's because trailers are cheap. They are the best bits of something, and they're the most potent emotional hits and whatever. But because I like, you know, cool things happening while emotive music swells, or gangs getting back together, or last stands, or ships exiting hyperspace, and all the various like emotional correlatives that I have from being quite stunted as a human being. That like almost all trailers work, even if I loathe the subject matter that they come from. The Call of Duty trailers work on me. Like, I can watch anything. I'm just, like, all you need is to show me, like, a fucking robot moving in slow motion, I'll probably cry. Like, I'm trying to think of the most recent one that really did work on me. I don't know.
Lots of people were very keen on the Beyond Earth intro they released as a trailer.
That was good. That wasn't kind of what I'm talking about. Nothing dramatically emerged. I mean, dramatic emergences are, like, a big thing for me. I don't know. I kept the a super high def version of the Mass Effect 2 launch trailer in my Steam library for like 3 years, so that I could watch it sometimes when I wanted to have feelings.
I just want to feel something. Yeah. I remember being really affected by the Mirror's Edge trailer. I think the first one ever, because I think that might have even been the first time they revealed it as well. Mm. And certainly it's the first time I'd have paid any attention to it. And it was not only one of the most artistically beautiful games ever. The song they played over it was fantastic too, and just mixed so well with the visual that it created this kind of unique sort of mood that actually I think the final game kind of has sometimes, but I mean that song isn't playing constantly as you're playing it, so it sometimes has a totally different atmosphere. And so most of the game is kind of, I associate more with the aesthetic experience of Mirror's Edge when I think about it, is these beautiful clean cities and then no music at all, and just the sound of like your breath and your feet like scratching against the ground. It's very visceral and very cool. But that trailer, it was all just serene, like spacey, semi-spacey, like just quite futuristic kind of music. I'm terrible at describing music.
It's a lot like Kevin Spacey.
And just like the way they
sold. I wanted that music to be my dad.
The idea of that game was, I think I knew even at the time it wouldn't be like quite like I was imagining it, but it was just this beautiful, you know, conjured this beautiful image of this city.
I think actually what that you kind of identify where it comes from me, and it is the combination of music and action. Like trailers are often just like music videos for games or for films or whatever. Like, it comes back to everything needing to be a musical, really. Like, better a musical. I mean, I've always wanted RPGs to have better musical accompaniments to like key moments. Obviously, orchestral soundtracks can be great and atmospheric or whatever, but I do like a good kind of bit of rhythm. It's nice.
Yeah, I suppose that's why since the Tears for Fears soundtrack trailer for Gears of War, we've just had like a relentless number of CG movies for games with anachronistic soundtracks. I think one of the better ones has been the Assassin's Creed Unity one.
Yeah, so the Lord version of Everybody Wants to Rule the World.
Yeah, so because I'm ignorant of how young people live, I didn't know the remake of that song, but it was really
good. I think that was the first time I'd heard that remake of that song, but I was aware of the singer. Yeah, I mean, Assassin's Creed did that. There was a good one for Assassin's Creed Revelations. Had a good
massive attack. They used a lot of. I think there's at least been at least two.
It was a massive attack for Revelations. I can't remember what it was, but that was a good trailer as well. Again, things happening in slow motion, boats, last stands, and the soundtrack. So I had feelings.
I always remember for Assassin's Creed 4, they, I don't know how many hundreds of trailers they did for it, but the best thing I ever saw that sold the game was a GIF someone posted on Reddit that was like 10 seconds long.
Oh, yeah.
The guy swinging from a rope, landing on another boat, skewering two guys, taking one as a human shield, then kicking someone off the edge of the boat, and that was it. I'm sold.
Yeah,
it had no sound, it was low res, looked ugly, but like, fuck, if I can do that, that's someone actually playing the game.
I'll tell you what was a trailer that used music really well. The Dishonored E3 trailer from the year it came out, because it came out later in the year, that was like, it was kind of like a montage. It was more like a montage of like slow motion action and landscapes from the game, but it was to a really like haunting version of What Should We Do with the Drunken Whaler. And there's a moment in that where like almost like a kind of like bass kind of kicks in, but it's more like a kind of like a ship's horn or something, and the kind of like the music kind of swells in a way that really suits like the tone of the game, and that was really well done.
Yeah, that was good
combination of music. And to the extent that I'm sad that music isn't in the game, like I don't know where you'd put it, but you kind of want that moment where actually. So this is something that just to briefly return to Inquisition. In whenever you go into a tavern in Inquisition, there's like a singer in the tavern or someone playing like a lute or something, and they've recorded an absolute shitload of original music for that game. Like there are 21 songs to kind of quote unquote collect, but all collecting them means is hearing them, and then the lyrics get added to your codex. But they are like original songs, and they're all like really nice, like folk songs. And like one of them, this is the nerdiest thing to fucking know, and this is actually probably the depth of this knowledge. One of them is a song from the soundtrack of the original Dragon Age, which was done with like an orchestral arrangement or like an electronic arrangement, depending on which part of the soundtrack you listen to it in, based on the OST for Dragon Age Origins, which was sung in Elvish, and they've redone it in English, and it's sung in Elvish. It's just like a harp in Dragon Age Inquisition. And I listened to that and I was like, I had all of those thoughts in that order, and I was really happy, and so you can't take that away from me.
I'm glad you're happy.
Did you have a soundtrack thing, Marsh?
No trailers have ever made me happy.
We're like opposites. Patrick Reckitt writes, what are your strangest or best experiences with ragdoll physics in games? Also, physics! 3 exclamation marks or 2 exclamation marks. Is that a Dark Souls thing?
No.
Is that something we yell?
It's just cool, isn't it? Physics?
Okay.
I think at the beginning, like 30 or so podcasts, we did shout physics quite a lot.
Oh, yeah. No, as well. Okay, fair enough.
We like physics.
We like shouting physics. It's nice to say loudly.
Do you remember the first time you encountered a ragdoll in a game? For me, it was Hitman 1.
Ooh.
And because it was a game mechanic in that, you know, you kill someone, then you need to put the body somewhere. But you couldn't pick them up, so you drag them by the wrist, basically, and then they would. It was really awkward. I can't remember how much they fixed this in later ones. I don't remember having to do it that much in later games. But it was all about, like, there's a corpse in the street, and now you've got to get out of the street, and there's these sewer grates, and you've got to get it to the sewer grate, and the sewer grate's a hole in the ground, but it's in front of you, and your character drags the ragdoll behind him. And there's no option to, like, dump it. I think that's how they solved it later, is that you would always get a use option just to dump the corpse in this, you know, locker or whatever hole or way of disposing it. And the first one, there was no button for that, so it was just, you drag it there, and you're like, maybe if I, like, turn around, the character would be persuaded to, like, to swing it around him a little bit. But if you turn around too slowly, then he just walks the other way, and then he's pulling it behind him still, but it hasn't gone down the hole, so you have to kind of try and walk past the hole a little bit and see if you could, like, felt like you're almost accidentally dragging him into the hole. It was kind of terrible.
I try to think. And there's so many that it's hard to pin down a particular one.
I really liked the physics glitches of Fallout 3. I was playing it. It was glitchy because it was preview or review code, I can't remember. But periodically, red scorpions would just fire off into the sky like an elastic band. And I saw it at 3 instances, all the kind of possible 3 instances you could see it. So at one point, there was just a red scorpion on the hill, and it was like, into the air. And then later, as I was walking through, maybe, I don't know, 30 hours later or something like that, I just saw, like, one score across the sky.
Yeah, hopefully the same
and
one.
I think it was almost towards... It must have been like one of the final missions of the game. You come out of, you know, you've been inside somewhere, some vault, and you emerge into the open landscape, and the character next to you starts saying something, and this red scorpion just went right in front of us. That's good.
I like, I really like the way that when, if a humanoid ragdoll is thrown through the air for long enough, it eventually goes into a kind of like Da Vinci, you know, kind of like star position, because the limbs will fully extend and it just sort of like cartwheels through the air forever. And I really like that when that happens to your player character, and you just, you know, like in Skyrim or something, it really glitches out and you get hit by a giant, you fly and you ping off into the sky, which is a Bethesda thing apparently. When you kind of get stuck like that, and it is just that moment of like, well, I this is how I live now.
That's how. That's what happened to every single person I killed in the last level of Call of Duty Advanced Warfare I played. Yeah, they immediately went into the...
Oh, the T-pose.
What pose?
The T-pose.
Yeah, the T-pose, yeah.
Because so if you're ragdolling and you're spinning through the air, the limbs naturally sort of extend into like a star shape.
Mm.
Or there's the modeler test pose where they have their legs together and their arms out, which is like so that the modeler can see all parts of the model, I guess. I had that with a companion in the expansion to Oblivion, Knights of the Nine.
Mm.
You have a sort of, like, the knights are a faction that you lead, and your, like, second-in-command is called Thedret, and mine had buggered out so that his arms would always be in the T-pose. But he would carry on acting like a normal character, and he would talk to you, and it kind of always give you this look of, like, what's wrong with you? So I'd always be staring at him, because he's, like, standing with his arms out like that. And so I called him Thedra the Exaggerator, because he looked like he's doing the, I caught a fish this big. But I got really attached to him, because he was like, I wrote an article about this for PC Gamer, which I think is online, so we can link it. Because he was unique. So every time he died, I had to reload a save game. I couldn't let him die, because I've got this unique character now that no one else has. Like, this is my guy. Like, no one else has the weird exaggerated guy.
One of my fondest, my favourite Skyrim videos is one where someone just tests with like modding Fusro Dar so it does in a stupid amount of physical force, like massive amount of it, and just sort of takes Lydia up a mountain, and she stands on the edge of the mountain, and she just sort of like crouches slightly, and like starts a conversation. She's like, yes, and he says like goodbye. He says goodbye, and then he goes to Fusro Dar, and she shoots off with such force that she almost immediately goes into like the star position, and you just see her cartwheeling into space, and she's just gone like over the horizon. The draw distance is set really high, and you see her going further and further and further away, and then she sort of starts to vanish, and a message pops up saying, your follower has left your service. Which I like is sort of the equivalent of like the Kerbal Space Program. Like,
to put it politely,
we've broken orbit. The Lydia Space Program.
Actually, that reminds me, I had another one in Oblivion, which is that game had a paralyze spell, which basically freezes the ragdoll of a person. Whatever pose they're in, regardless of what animation is playing, they get fixed like that. And then physics takes over and they just collapse.
Oh, yeah.
But they are still rigid. Like, they will stay in that pose with, like, a little bit of squishiness to it. And you also had spell making in that game, which is something I've really missed in Skyrim. So you could take any effect and any way of applying it and combine them. And so I use spell making facilities to make myself a paralysis spell on self. So all the spells do is paralyze me. And then I go up to the top of the highest mountain and cast it. The pose that you do when you cast it is I'm wearing like a robe and I throw my hand up dramatically and do a kind of like, yeah, casting animation, and light comes out of my hand, and then I just freeze like that because I just cast paralysis on myself, and then just slowly keel over and then stuck completely in that pose, tumble down a mountain and pick up more and more and more speed and bounce all the way to the bottom. That was what I did for fun. It would only paralyze me for like I was like a master level illusionist, so I had the most powerful version of that spell, but it was still only like 10 seconds or something, so sometimes I'd have to like it would wear off, and then I'd pick myself up on a ledge and then I'd have to paralyze myself again all the rest of the way down.
I wonder what the other denizens of that world made of you. Fucking weirdo.
They say she's the greatest illusionist in the world.
You're the Steve O of
You said just Steve O, like my granddad would say Steve O.
How are you going to say Steve O?
Stephen O.
All right.
Sorry.
How do you say cruel. Steve?
Steve-O.
I don't even know. Well, let's carry on with the podcast.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that.
That's right, carry on.
All right. We're actually out of questions.
And on that awkward note.
And on that awkward note, I'm sorry, Marsh.
You can. It's fine. I fully admit I may not pronounce that name correctly.
You articulate well. You enunciate well. And sometimes it's quite formal.
Excellent.
On that note, if you'd like to send us a question, you can ask Tom how you do that, because that's how this works.
It's questions at crateandcrowbar.com.
It is.
And you can also post on our forums, crateandcrowbar.com/forum. And you can tweet at us. We're at Crate and Crowbar on Twitter. We have a YouTube channel, which is now youtube.com/crateandcrowbar. And you should watch the Dark Souls 2 series going on there.
Yeah. Good plug.
And if you'd like to follow us individually, I am at Pentadact on Twitter. That's Pentadact.
I'm at C Thurston. That's Churston.
I'm at Marsh Davis. It's Davies.
Thanks for listening, everyone.